Hi, I'm Jeremy Kirk with Intel 471, and welcome to the first installment of a video series we're calling Studio 471. I'll be speaking with security experts about some of the most pressing issues of the day. And today with me is Brett Winterford, who's regional CSO in APJ for Okta. Thank you very much for joining me, Brett.
Jeremy, awesome to be one of your first guests on the show. Thank you for inviting me.
And so we're going to talk about strong authentication today, how to strengthen authentication to match the risk environment, and also some paths to get there to stronger authentication, and also some of what we're seeing at Intel 471 as far as what adversaries are doing around credential theft and initial access brokers. So I'm curious, you know, I mean, Okta is a huge player in the authentication space, and are you seeing, you know, when people come to Okta and they're interested in changing that the way that they authenticate, what are some of the drivers that are causing them to make those calls to say, hey, I think we need help?
Yeah, no worries. Well, usually the typical use case for coming to Okta is not necessarily for stronger authenticators, funnily enough. It's usually for all of the backend plumbing we do to make access work. So if you can access all of your applications with the same set of credentials and the same policies, obviously there's some net security benefits. You're not, you don't have the proliferation of passwords across various cloud services, et cetera. But often you'll have existing customers make decisions about, you know, stepping up their authenticator assurance, moving to higher assurance factors. That's a harder decision to make in a lot of ways because you've got an authentication flow, a sign-in flow that people are really used to, particularly on customer identity. It's pretty hard to change people's behaviors. So generally speaking, your security teams want higher assurance authenticators, right? They want something that's phishing resistant. They want something that's device bound, hardware protected. So they're pushing for things like passwordless access with FastPass or FIDO2 Web Authent. The blocker usually is maybe some folks in digital or even IT teams who are goaled differently to security teams. They're goaled on something like user experience. And they have this assumption that these modern methods of signing in they're not familiar with, and that maybe users aren't familiar with, and maybe that could be a barrier. The reasons for change is either that the security team wins the argument, that doesn't happen easily. What normally helps the security team win the argument is the adversary, the kind of stuff that you guys observe in your line of work. So we proactively warn our customers about phishing campaigns that are targeted at their org. If there's any way we detect that they've kind of emulated the Okta login or sign-in experience, we've sent out thousands of notifications to our customers to say, we think you're about to be under attack. That kind of experience can change up, can be a really good force for change. So is a really good red team exercise that will often drive that change, or an incident. It's usually one of the three. Or I guess if you're made aware that some of your credentials are available for sale on the dark web, that's probably a good motivator too. I'm guessing since you've joined Intel 471, you've probably seen quite a bit of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we're seeing, the credential brokering, it's probably the cause of 30% of breaches, probably 30% of ransomware attacks are attributable to some sort of credential theft. And I mean, it's absolutely, absolutely prolific. So I mean, I pulled some stats for 2023. And so, what we do, our analysts do, is basically monitor all these underground forums for adverts of threat actors saying, hey, I've got credentials for this sort of organization. And oftentimes it's kind of, they're sort of vague about the organization that's being accessed. And they're also vague about that kind of access, but that's also sometimes our analysts are able to suss that out through human intelligence. So engaging threat actors and, trying to tease out, well, who is this Fortune 500 company in the automotive sector, for example, that you have credentials to, and sometimes you can find out that way, but, we have an estimate of like the number of victims just this year since January that were affected by some sort of credential theft. And it was more than 1,700 coming from 140 some access brokers. So, it's always kind of difficult to tell on the surface if, somebody's saying like, oh, Is this threat actor lying, right? Because that's the big thing that you come into with CTI of like, are people telling the truth or are they lying? Do they actually have what they say they have? And that's why, you know, we do a lot of adversary research and have historical data into, you know, threat actor names and go, okay, well, this person has a really good track record. So they probably have, you know, what they say they have. Yeah, they are. And, you know, as far as the type of credentials too, it's, I mean, it's all the usual suspects. It's RDP, it's remote access software, VPN software, anything that remotely connects. Those are amongst the sort of like, kind of like hottest sort of credentials. But, you know, I also pulled some stats on just kind of like the number of reported breaches or suspected breaches. And just in May, we file these breach alerts for our customers where we just do like a little summary of like this threat actor is claiming a breach of this particular organization. So we track 403 of those just in May alone. So that's like, that's 10 to 15 a day. And that's just the ones that, you know, we're having visibility on. So it's not, so it's just, again, it's like any vendor who collects stats on, you know, a sort of underground stuff. It's kind of a slice of what you have visibility over. But I mean, I still find that like pretty astounding, right? That, you know, the actual breach activity could be, you know, double, triple, I don't know, an order of magnitude higher than that. This is the stuff that's just kind of like popping up. And so that's why, you know, even if you look at public breach reports of like, well, what caused this? And they're like, well, it's kind of stolen credentials or stolen session cookies as well. And it's just really put the emphasis on you have to authenticate in stronger ways, right? Like even MFA over SMS. I mean, everybody knows that that's not a good way to do it. Better than nothing, but even MFA is proving not as resilient as, you know, it should be. And, you know, that's why I asked you about that. It's like, is that why, you know, you did say after an incident, that is why people come to you. And do you see some of them actually saying like, you know, we suspect it was, you know, theft of session token that led to our breach?
Yeah, absolutely. So we typically speaking, we would have some level of observability if there was an adversary in the middle phishing campaign that targeted that organization. But what's changing the landscape, you might remember we actually just spoke about this about 9 months ago, is that adversary in the middle phishing, which is where, you know, there's a real-time phishing proxy between the target and the website they would typically authenticate to, that can then, you know, relay the MFA between the two and capture both the password and the session token. That kind of capability was boutique, you know, back in 2017, 2018.
Yeah.
And in about 2021, we started seeing of all of the phishing infrastructure that we identify proactively, that it was more than 50% of them were now using that capability. Wow. But again, it was targeted attacks, a lot of attacks on software companies, telcos, fintechs, cryptocurrency adjacent industry. That was the targeted attack places, right? But now what's changed since kind of mid last year is we're starting to see these phishing as a service tools like Evil Proxy, Naked Pages, etc., where these capabilities that used to be, I guess, a little bit cumbersome to set up. So both the proxy configuration, but also all the capabilities to defeat conditional access rules, all the capabilities to avoid analysis, they're accessible to the least skilled actors in the community now as a service. So I think we're going to see a lot more of it, and it's not going to be as targeted anymore. We've seen a lot of campaigns in February or March of this year targeting Microsoft 365 that were huge in volume. I mean, it's difficult for us to assess because we only see when there is a federation event between 365 and Okta that we can actually see that this activity took place. We don't have the same visibility Microsoft would have just how big the problem is, but it's getting to be the kind of tool you can use in kind of a spray and pray kind of approach to attacking, you know, from folks like business email compromise actors, rather than being a really targeted form of attack. All that being said, I'm assuming, and maybe you can back me up on this, that most of the stolen session tokens that you would see are caused by info stealers, by malware on an endpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. So we monitor botnets and exactly what botnets are doing and what sort of spam campaigns are running and what sort of executables that those downloads or those that are happening on the infected machines. And so again, info stealers, tremendous amount. So, I mean, a lot of that stuff is aimed, like, I think you probably remember the Genesis market, part of which was taken down by law enforcement, part of which is still sort of running. And so basically they're harvesting all of those session tokens for all kinds of different service providers, you know, from those endpoints. And then you can either kind of buy it directly from them or buy it from some IABs and go, okay, right, I just want the ones for Okta, you know, or O365. You know, I don't need the ones for like eBay or whatever, but, you know, there'll be another level of threat actors, lower level threat actors that are doing that sort of fraud that might be interested in. But then, you know, if
so you're saying there is a service, there's service providers just to comb through the bots,
to sort through the logs too. Yeah. Because there's so much information that's being collected, and I think that part of the economy is also trying to just make it easier for people to go through it and get the kind of credentials they want so they can make sales ultimately.
Yeah.
So then rather than I'm going to sell you, like, you know, 15 terabytes of, you know, just enormous amounts of data that you would have to, like, here's, okay, I want this, give me this, right? And just making it easier to sort those logs. And so you kind of get that sort of separation of threat actors as well. Again, as you get the people who want to do like PayPal fraud or whatever, we'll get, you know, those sorts of things. Whereas you get, like, you know, the threat actors that want like Okta, right? You're talking, okay, well, they're going after something a little bit higher level and maybe with different kind of motivations as well. But I mean, again, it's just absolutely prolific. And I guess this is another thing I wanted to talk to you about, was just because, you know, when you steal sessions, you have an active session for as long as that token is valid. And so I guess my question is, like, you know, we talked a little bit last time about the NIST digital identity guidelines and authenticator assurance. Is like, well, should you set apps to time out more frequently than those apps that are more sensitive? And, you know, what are you seeing as far as that? It's like, I'm going to make somebody log into, you know, Splunk once a day because that's going to be a really sensitive application. Do you see that happening in the field?
Well, what I do see is obviously the organizations that are really attuned to this, that have got strong policies, they're absolutely reducing the duration of their IDP sessions and often their app sessions as well. So you can reduce the session times at the IDP, so at Okta or Azure AD, whoever you're using. But you've got to remember your application sessions have to be managed separately. The duration of those sessions are managed within those actual, you know, the admin consoles of those applications. So over the past few years, we've seen that the default session duration for a lot of SaaS apps has actually moved in the opposite direction. They've got longer.
Why is that?
Well, I think because a lot of organizations are getting a lot more confidence about the assurance of a session because of the authenticators that are available. Kind of zero trust approach we can take to access. So we can write policies that say, I will only allow access based on whether or not there's that device is successfully authenticated to this application before, you know, whether it's coming from a particular location, you know, whether it's a registered or a managed device, the device posture, you know, previous user behaviors. These are all things that can be assessed at the point of authentication that can give more assurance to the administrator. That said, considering what we've just spoken about, both InfoStealer malware and adversary in the middle phishing, you know, naturally I'm of the view as a security professional that we should be quite prudent about session duration. And that's why I think the NIST digital identity guidelines are great, because it's not me telling customers, it's you know, a respected standards body that's saying, please, you know, sort your apps into these groups, AL1, AL2, AL3, based on the sensitivity of those apps. And then decide, like, what is the minimum strength authenticator you need to access those different groups of applications? And for some of the higher sensitivity applications, you need to have idle timeouts that can be quite short, you know, 15 minutes or 30 minutes. If I step away from my device for a period of time and I'm not using that application, I might need to re-authenticate. And fairly, you know, sensible session duration. And the thing that I try and make a point to a lot of Okta customers, and I think this is generic to anyone who's out there, is that If you modernize your authentication, if you move to passwordless authenticators, if you're using things like Okta FastPass or FIDO2 Web Authent, then your two-factor authentication challenge, so your multiple, you know, satisfying multiple factors during sign-in goes from like 20 to 30 seconds on average with, say, a password plus an OTP, down to 3 to 4 seconds, because your device is already an authenticator and all you're really doing is, you know, scanning your finger or your face to prove your user presence. And so now authenticating takes 3 to 4 seconds. If I have to authenticate several times a day, because someone like me or you, you know, we access sensitive information on a fairly routine basis, I don't mind having to re-authenticate fairly often, because it's not much of a disruption to my workflow to simply reach over and scan my finger. Now, obviously, I'm blessed. I'm using Mac OS. I've got the best bells and whistles at my disposal. But the point is, that's where we should be moving. We should be moving to a world in which, you know, as the Zero Trust mantra says, you know, we have session-based, least privileged access, and we are asked to re-authenticate when any conditions change about our particular session. So, for example, with FastPass, our passwordless authenticator, now we have the capability to, every time someone accesses a new application or interacts with the Okta dashboard, it will assess device signal again. It'll keep reassessing it. Is that still the device we expect it to be? And that's kind of where we need to think about moving to, because the adversaries would prefer to just be stealing passwords for access to a VPN to get access to a network. I mean, that's just so much easier, right? And I assume that's what most of the initial access brokers are working with.
Yeah.
As more and more organizations modernize their approach to access, it's going to come down to session tokens then. So I think that's the frame of thinking that we all need to head in, even if it seems a little bit beyond us now.
Because they're not going to be able to sit on it, right? As soon as they get access, they're going to have to move on it quickly. It's because I think another stat that we had from last year that was pretty interesting, like we tried to kind of look at like when did credentials go up for sale versus when did an organization have a breach? And so this is kind of like trying to correlate, like particularly with ransomware, of kind of like, well, when did that happen? And did, oh, look, we saw that this reliable IAB put this stuff up for sale. So we calculated around 79 days in 2022. And so, you know, at least, you know, for our customers, that's the gap, right? That we can say, okay, we have intelligence that you might be next, because this is what's going up. But that period is always going to get shorter and shorter, of course, you know, and they're going to try to capitalize on that access a lot faster, which is where that, you know, that sort of device signaling comes in. Okay, here's a new device, right? Coming from somewhere. Mm-hmm. This is odd. Let's try to slow this down or put other, I guess, what challenges in place. Is that what would happen in that sort of scenario?
Yeah. So like if a device context changes mid-session, you can force re-authentication basically at that point. You can write workflows that will kill the session as well. I mean, you can write workflows that will, if the application supports single logout, go and kill the application sessions too. But that's an extreme that the more, you know, sensitive organizations like us, you know, in our own use of Okta will do. Not everyone is at that level where they're prepared to kill sessions quite, when they get good high confidence signals that something has changed about the context of a session. That's something we do because we have, obviously, you know, the expertise in this area, the security team resources, being really close to the product helps us write the kind of workflows that can do that. Again, I think that's where we're all moving in the future, is kind of this orchestrations that recognize a change in behavior during a session and take some kind of remediative action. You mentioned 79 days. Is that's the average time from when a credential is offered for sale and the credential is known to have been used in an attack?
The average time when a credential was collected, monetized on a cybercrime forum and then used by a ransomware affiliate.
Okay, right. Yeah, okay. 79 days is, that's a relief to me because when I think about session tokens, but I mean, when we're thinking about bots, like a stolen session that might be valid for, you know, only a couple of days at a time at most. They must have mechanisms for exploiting that faster.
Right? Oh, absolutely. And it does happen faster. I mean, with ransomware, I think they've timed, at least the initial intrusion by a ransomware affiliate to when they launch ransomware. Sometimes it's just been a matter of hours. So, sometimes, if they don't exfil first, they may just go straight in and just straight to encrypt. That's happened before. If they go in and they want to exfil, that might take a while. And of course, that raises the risks for them that they're going to get caught. We saw that with some attacks here in Australia where, one organization said they stopped a pre-ransomware event, so they stopped it at that stage. It definitely does happen faster. I think that, it depends on the case and the threat actor who's interested in the credentials and how, capable they are of moving. Mm-hmm. I mean, ransomware, you definitely put those groups at the top end of the, some of the most skilled people. If they wanted to execute faster, they could. And then you have other like IABs who just have credentials for some, maybe their advert isn't very good, so nobody's bought it. So there's still that wider gap. So
they're live for a lot longer. That longer tail means that the average gets pushed out, but the adversary you worry about is moving a lot faster.
Exactly. Exactly.
Have you seen that DFIR report? DFIR report. It's called. It's a Twitter.
That great website. Yeah.
And they just do a. They just give you an idea of these kind of speed runs of how quickly a ransomware affiliate went from initial access to, domain controller, basically. And the diversity of ways they do it and the speed with which they do it. Every time I read a report, I silently am so glad that I'm not working for a security team that has to manage a Windows network, because the number of paths available to these initial access brokers and their speed and capabilities, not the brokers, the affiliates, is it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and I think that that case that I was describing where the ransomware affiliate, just as soon as it got in, basically began encrypting. I think that was a DFIR case study, that it was just a matter of hours. It was like some one of the fastest movements I think that had been sort of seen of a group just moving to that phase. But they do tremendous case studies of this kind of stuff. So yeah, even though that in some ends are maybe, weeks, some might just be hours, just depending on, who thinks that they can monetize it, I guess.
Yeah. And what shocked you, I guess, since you've joined Intel 471? What aspect of this cybercrime ecosystem has kind of surprised you the most since you've had this increased level of visibility?
I think it's like the scale of it. I mean, everybody knew it was bad. Everybody knew in security that the number of organizations that are just like the public disclosures of data breaches was getting, pretty voluminous, that we were all kind of getting numb on it. But it's just, to use a cliche, it is sort of just the tip of the iceberg. And just what I was talking about earlier of in the month of May, we'd filed 403 breach alerts. And so those breach alerts can be used by organizations themselves, or, they can monitor their suppliers to see if somebody's claiming that, one of their suppliers has been hit. And the scale of it, it's just shocking. I mean, it's just like this tally, like every single day. So it kind of supports like some of the, statistics that I think, the FBI's IC3 Internet Crime Complaint Center releases, aggregated statistics about cybercrime. And it just seems like, yes, this supports all of it when you see, individual, threat actor names. And sometimes, you see the same names popping up. Like, for instance, we tracked, the top IABs for 2022. And this is quite interesting. So one of them is called Galaxy, another is called Hershey, and another one's called Lint. And so those aren't the actual threat actor NICs. Those are chocolate bars. And so we just renamed it for when we talk about this stuff publicly, to not, alert them specifically to it. But it's just quite interesting. Like these are the top sort of sellers, and, the access offered by number one, Galaxy, it was Citrix, Microsoft RDP, Pulse Secure VPNs, right? So not terribly surprising. Number two, was offering malware logs. So there you go. There's your sort of like info stealer type stuff. Citrix, Pulse Secure, Global Protect. And then the third one, it was Cisco AnyConnect, Global Protect, Pulse Secure, RDWeb, which is RDP, and Citrix. So it's just, it's very, very common. And so, I mean, at least that should give practitioners, right, of, you know, if you're using those technologies to have your users connect, you know, especially through, I mean, I just, what was it, just yesterday, there was a vulnerability in Fortinet, Fortinet OS again. It's the same stuff that's been happening like the 2 or 3 years. Like they really favor that sort of remote access and VPN thing. So if you have like remote facing assets and internet facing assets that's you know, could potentially have vulnerabilities in them, you know, it's just kind of like, I, at least for me, it's been so clear that you have to move to strong authentication and zero trust architectures. I mean, because otherwise it's just, you're just gambling, right? Until something happens. I don't know. What do you think?
The patch fatigue's too high. Like you can't, when this Fortinet release came out in the last few hours, you know, Fortinet makes some great products. They're trying to make them affordable for people. But I saw a whole bunch of admins in the forums just saying, how can we possibly keep up? Like, we, you know, our jobs are becoming to patch network edge devices in a hurry all the time, have the same arguments with the network infrastructure group we had last week and the week before and the week before. It's, we're not making progress. So there definitely has to be, some big change on that front. I don't think that there is going to be enough investment in some of these, I guess, you know, moving outside of VPNs and firewalls, but even just anything that is on-prem and internet accessible at the moment, you've got to question whether the vendor is putting the right amount of investment into it, because they're probably developing a cloud version of the same on-prem tool.
Yep.
That's where their investment is going. If there is, you know, if there are software engineers really focused on the quality of the code, you know, that's where their energy and investment is going. We saw it with Exchange, right? Like a lot of organizations would still prefer to run their own Microsoft Exchange box. And I understand their motivations for wanting to do it. I absolutely get it. But if this infrastructure is kind of left out to pasture for a little while, it becomes a real problem for defenders. So this is one of the reasons that you know, cloud offers some benefits. Yes, you lose some visibility, observability, some things that make you feel more comfort when you're working in a new infrastructure or a security team. But you know, the emphasis of having, you know, a team of security professionals absolutely focused on one, you know, one particular attack surface. And it's not just our team, right? In Okta's case, we allow our customers to pen test their own Okta org. We get third-party pen testers every year. You know, we perform tests on the service and we share the results with our customers. So it's kind of all eyes on one place, right?
Yeah.
And it means that there is a concentration of risk, but it also means that you're not going to be responsible for being on that patch treadmill constantly. And that's why I believe that in the very careful balance of what the right approach is, that the approach you just said, you know, zero trust access using cloud services is probably going to be a safer course of action in the end.
And don't leave your managed file transfer appliance facing the internet.
Oh, boy.
I mean, this is, you know, and what happened with Clop, and just to kind of back up, you know, this is the latest example of another, you know, big, you know, Clop is intentionally hunting for managed file transfer appliances. They did it with Excellian, they did it with Fortress Go Anywhere. And it's clear that Clop is using ransoms to fund exploit development and to hunt for bugs, right? And this is the result. So I just think, you know, again, just as you're saying, you know, with Microsoft 2, you know, Hafnium back in early 2021, any of this infrastructure that's internet facing is like, you've got to move away from it because it's just, yeah, just untenable almost anymore.
Unless you have the kind of security team and software engineering capabilities in your organization that you... you can actually maintain that infrastructure to close to the same degree as a cloud service provider. That's, you know, they're the exceptions. And I understand there are a bunch of organizations out there that one have that capability and two, you know, have reasons why, you know, some particular reason, often it's regulatory or some particularly, some particular sensitivity that means that they have to run that infrastructure. I get that. But you've just got to make sure that the powers that be at those organizations understand that it comes at a cost. You need warm bodies, very, very skilled individuals to be managing that infrastructure.
So as a final question, Brett, I want to ask you about, because you watch a lot of organizations transition from whatever they're using for authentication to stronger authentication. And you said you had some interesting, like an interesting case study around this. Can you tell me about one of those organizations and maybe some of the issues that they encountered or how it went?
Yeah, cool. I've been collecting case studies lately of folks that went to FastPass or WebAuthn and went so in a hurry. Sometimes, as I mentioned, it's because they've been targeted. And so we've already sent them a warning and then kept in touch with them and watched them change up their authentication at that point. There was a great one the other day where I met the folks from GitLab who did this 48-hour speed run. They just decided we're going to have every single employee signing in only with WebAuthn within 48 hours.
Wild.
And prior to that, they had a pretty broad mix of authenticators. Like they really left it to their employees to decide what the strongest authenticators were. I mean, they're a tech company. So the people were making smart choices already. I'm pretty sure it was something like 20% already of their employees were using WebAuthn because they understand the risk and they took it upon themselves. But to get the other 80%, you know, all like to mandate phishing-resistant authentication in 48 hours. It's a pretty wild case study. And this is an example of an organization where they kind of stated the reasons why the threat environment had changed to the point that was important. They had this collaborative culture of saying, like, if any of you have strong opinions about the best way to communicate this or the best way to make this happen, you know, they'd open up a document, have anyone in the company come in and make suggestions. And they really kind of had this, I think it's a cultural thing for them. They have the right culture at their organization that they could pull that off.
Yep. Yep.
There's lots of things that you can learn from organizations like that. Edge cases, for example, I mean, they did discover those minor edge cases where a phishing resistant authenticator won't do the job. So just
to clarify, were these hardware security keys? Or are these an agent running on machines? Or how does it, what exactly did they implement?
For this particular company, I'm pretty sure, and I hope I don't get this wrong, that it was just, it was web authentic. It didn't matter whether it was a platform authenticator. So your Touch ID, Face ID, Windows Hello.
Okay.
So the credential is stored in your TPM on your device or a roaming physical key. And I think they were making the physical keys available to anyone who wanted them, but you could just use the platform authenticator. And I know Figma, you know, the design cloud company, when they'd gone wall to wall phishing resistant, they found after issuing a bunch of physical security keys, a lot of people were just fine using the platform authenticator. They just found it natural to use the authenticator built into the device.
And that's because you're verifying you've got that device, you've cryptographically got that actual device, and you are you authenticating to that device. And that's what makes that.
So basically you've got the private key stored in your TPM, the public key shared with the server. So whenever you authenticate, there's a cryptographic binding between those two. And then from there, it's just really about proving that it's actually you that's at that device. And that's satisfying a possession factor and an inheritance factor if there's a biocheck. So pretty powerful because it's fast, it's phishing resistant, it's fairly intuitive and easy. I think this is one of those experiences, funnily enough, where a lot of people are finding that their workforce authentication now is so much easier than their personal life. Remember when it used to be the other way around? Our use of personal applications informed us about what good looked like, and it's flipped now, which is great. But I think passkeys will change that, because passkeys is the multi-device FIDO credentials, which means basically WebAuthn for the masses when they're signing into different applications, their insurer, their bank, their anyone, their email service provider. This is basically taking, instead of a device-bound WebAuthn credential, like what these organizations are rolled out now, Google and Apple and Microsoft and the like are introducing passkeys, which are multi-device. You can share that credential across multiple devices so that you have the same credential to access different services from different devices, from different browsers, which is very powerful. And it's a confusing time at the moment for folks in the industry, because the spec hasn't really settled. There are a lot of folks organizations with low tolerance for risk are saying, actually, I prefer a WebAuthn credential that was device bound. I'd prefer it to be.
Sure. Yeah.
I want to know that it's that, that was that particular user's device. And in that case, we've been recommending FastPass, our own proprietary authenticator, because it does more or less the same thing, but is device bound. We're finding other ways to work with WebAuthn to make that, work as well. It's interesting, the take up of these authenticators is still really low. And we just released a report called the secure signing report this morning, actually, that looks at the adoption of different authenticators in workforce. And you can see that, FastPass and WebAuthn are still minnows. They're very, very small compared to SMS, OTP apps, push, etc. Yes. But they're also the highest growth. So half of the growth in the last 12 months has been from those authenticators. So clearly the message is getting out there that you really do need to move to stronger authenticators. But we have a massive road ahead in terms of transitioning all those users. And then I think it'll take a little longer on the customer identity front, because we just need passkeys to get better understood by the average consumer, to actually, you only have to experience it once and I think you get it. But before, it's a bit daunting before then. And the irony is that, there is some anxiety out there that maybe users will expect more friction, that they'll actually find it too easy and worry that maybe it could be susceptible to compromise, because it seems like magic. I'm just logged in. Well, but I didn't seem to have to do anything, So it's going to be an interesting journey, I think, over the next 12 months, particularly. So I look forward to repeating this data exercise in another 12 months and seeing where we've landed.
Well, Brett, I enjoyed the chat as usual. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you. And congrats on your work there at Intel 471. Really, really interesting to hear some of your insights there on what's happening from what you guys can observe.
Thanks a lot. Industry.